This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners who support us on Patreon. Family members get ad-free episodes, merch discounts, pre-sales on live events, live monthly trivia, and monthly bonus shows. More information at patreon.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
You cannot control everything, Strange. You opened the doorway between universes, and we don't know who or what will walk through it.
When Marvel's Doctor Strange opened the doorway between universes, the studio was rewarded with many billions of dollars in ticket sales, which means that the multiverse, for now anyway, is here to stay, Josh.
With Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Marvel's latest, directed by Sam Raimi, out this weekend, it opens a doorway for us to return to a more innocent era of superhero movie making, back to 2002, and to Raimi's Spider-Man, which turns 20 this year.
Let's get him, Tiger.
I think you're quoting Spider-Man 2 there, but I'll allow it because I love it when you call me Tiger. Ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. You're on multiverse duty this week, Josh, as I did not end up making the Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness screening. And I know listeners who heard my lament last week are like, yeah, Adam, you sound really bummed. What, did you have to wash your hair?
They were shocked by that.
You know, I had a conflict, Josh. It happens.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to give us a tease of your review? What did I miss?
Well, I filed a review for multiple universes. So in one, I loved it. One, I hated it. One, I mean, you know, I've got everybody covered. So we'll see which one we end up with later in the show.
See, that just sounds like a lot of work, like the movie itself, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Along with your thoughts on Marvel's latest, we'll also hear from friend Steve Procopi, one of the critics responsible for curating this year's Chicago Critics Film Festival, which opens on the 13th of this month. This year's lineup also acts as a nice preview of some of the most anticipated films of the year.
But first, I think the only way to get into our review of 2002's Spider-Man is with a Willem Dafoe Green Goblin cackle.
Peter, may I introduce my father, Norman Osborn?
Great honor to meet you, sir.
Harry tells me you're quite the science whiz. You know, I'm something of a scientist myself.
What the hell is that?
Whatever it is, somebody has to stop it.
With great power comes great responsibility.
This is my gift.
Wow.
It is my curse.
Who are you?
Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
When I was 4 or 5, I was interviewed for my mom's company newsletter. One of the questions was, what do you want to be when you grow up? No, my answer wasn't astronaut or policeman or fireman. I wanted to be Spider-Man. Sam Raimi's Spider-Man didn't send me running in search of my old red and blue spandex tights, but let's just say I thought about it. That was how I opened my review of Raimi's Spider-Man, released this week back in 2002, when I was a grad student cutting my critical teeth at the Daily Iowan. Fun fact, I'm pretty sure that Spidey review concluded my 2-year run at the DI. Let's see if you can identify this one, Josh. As someone who used to dress up in Spider-Man underoos and literally try to climb walls when I was a kid, the highest praise I can give this high-flying adaptation from director Sam Raimi is to say it made me want to be Spider-Man again.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said it so I don't have to.
That's the opening to your capsule review of Spider-Man, of course, and I'm tempted to suggest the connection proves we were destined to do this show together.
Maybe.
Except for the fact that we could probably find, I don't know, a few 100,000 Gen X males who would have started their reviews similarly. Nevertheless, clearly, we were ready for Raimi and Spider-Man. So were most moviegoers. We had Blade and X-Men and Tim Burton's Batman and the Superman movies before that. But this was pre-Sony having to crank out a Spidey movie every 5 years or else relinquish the IP. Pre-MCU, pre-DCEU, pre-anyone ever using the phrase cinematic universe at all, as far as I can recall. The release also came just 8 months after 9/11. A teaser featured footage of bank robbers caught in one of Spidey's webs spun between the Twin Towers, and included a shot of the towers reflected in the eyes of his mask. That footage was pulled within a few days of the attacks. Watching Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin streak across the Manhattan skyline and throw bombs at a tall building hits different post-9/11, still. Same for the climactic action scene where Tobey Maguire's wall crawler thwarts the bad guy terrorist with an assist from angry New Yorkers, and Spidey's final swing from the pole of an American flag waving gloriously atop the Empire State Building. Was that spirit why Spider-Man was the biggest box office earner of its year, grossing a full 100 million more domestically than Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, and was the sixth highest grossing film overall at the time of its release? Or was it simply because it's such a well-made, rousing, character-driven action movie with no multiverses, but a multitude of memorable scenes? Looking back at my notes from the Spider-Man 3 review on the show, I commented that despite my strong appreciation for Spider-Man 2, and let's be clear, I know that it has some great sequences, at the time I couldn't immediately recall iconic scenes from it the way I could with its predecessor. And the handful of scenes I jotted down then were all among my favorites on this rewatch. In the parlance of our teenage kids, I'd love to hear your top five iconic Spider-Man moments. And tell me, which one had you locked in your bedroom, struggling to fit into those old underoos, with knocks on the door and you saying, "I'm exercising. I'm not dressed, Debbie."
Oh, if I still had those, I would be so happy. Did you have those? Did you get on the underoo craze?
Oh, of course I did.
Okay, good.
Of course I did.
I'm relieved.
Spidey, Superman.
Yep, I'm relieved to hear that. I'm also relieved to hear that your answer to your mom's company newsletter wasn't, "I foresee myself managing a team of 15 to 20 very confidently and competently." I mean,
no,
I'm so glad to hear there was a very young,
yeah,
superhero aspiring Adam,
yeah,
out there.
Before I wasn't beaten down and jaded yet.
Before he started, you know, claiming The Right Stuff was his best film, or mm-hmm, what's the other one? The GARP one.
The World,
you know,
to GARP.
Like GARP,
yeah,
formed me.
That's
at
what
age
did
four.
It to me, actually.
Okay. Yeah, that's nice. I like picturing you that way. It's interesting because I would say Burton's Batman, I was still, you know, in, was it middle school or just before high school, but mm-hmm, saw that as a complete fan, right? And was as excited about it as I could possibly be. Always loved Spider-Man more than Batman, but, you know, liked Batman 2 as a kid. And then Spider-Man, Raimi's Spider-Man 2002 is where I had to think about this somewhat professionally, right? Theoretically, at this point, this was my job, and it was my job as writing for the Naperville Sun at that point. And I remember sitting in the screening. It was at Piper's Alley, which doesn't exist anymore as a movie theater in Chicago. And there was another critic a couple rows ahead of me who came, probably a little older than us, came wearing a Spider-Man t-shirt. And as soon as the credits started, just started rocking back and forth in his seat. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, still somewhat trying to figure this out. Where's mm-hmm, the line of professionalism, yeah, and personal enthusiasm?
You and Mr. Purist were so unhappy.
I just didn't know what to do with that.
Uh-huh.
I like to think maybe I've gotten past that because my review, as you saw, even in that opening that you quoted, was purely enthusiastic and tied into the same sort of response, you know? And that is kind of how I responded to it watching it again. This movie is just so sweet, which I think mm-hmm, I had forgotten. It's very self-contained in the way you've already talked about. There, not only are there no multiverses, there's no cinematic universes, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be better, but I did appreciate how this story really, it affected all those New Yorkers who were caught as bystanders, but it really involves maybe 7 to 8 people, right?
Right.
Peter's family, Mary Jane, and then the Osborns. And that's pretty much who this, it doesn't affect not only this whole planet, or universe or multiverses. It's just this group of 10 or less. And there was something intimate about that that I did appreciate. So I think this stands up, you know, obviously it stood up at the time. Fascinating for you to bring 9/11 into it, because I had totally forgotten that context. And you're absolutely right. That was on everybody's minds at the time. That's an element to it as well. But I just think you're right. It's really well made, hits all the right buttons that we want a movie like this to hit, and is still, in ways that we can probably get into, a Sam Raimi movie, which is another thing I was excited about at the time, you know? So I mean, speaking of where I was, I had taken, Debbie and I had gone on a date to see Darkman. So I was, you know, that much of kind of aware of Raimi at that point, many years earlier. To have him take on Spider-Man was another reason for me to be excited, and to see it come through and have touches of him as a filmmaker, I really fell for it. So I think at some point you asked me about scenes. Do you want me to jump into those too?
Yeah. Are you just ignoring my query, my demand for your five favorites?
No, let's do it.
Let's do it.
I'm going to say, as you may not be surprised based on how I set up or transitioned us here, anytime Willem Dafoe cackles, I just love the enthusiasm. And he's not above this part either, right? He's not kind of trying to have it both ways, where he's really committed but is also letting us know somehow that he's above this comic book material. I think he's all in. I think it's a great villain performance.
Mm-hmm.
Another highlight scene. My name is the human spider. Peter's insistence on that rather than Bruce Campbell's, you know, obviously the perfect name.
He doesn't
Spider-Man.
Realize it's better. He insists. You're
yes.
right.
The whole wrestling match sequence, minus that, you know, homophobic quip that still is in the script that certainly dates it in a negative way. Number three would be this exchange. You're taller than you look. I hunch. Don't. Just the economy of that. How much
so
work
good.
Do those three lines do? Yep. David Koepp, screenwriter, of course, here. Number two, the whole trying out his powers sequence. And this is the one where it was like, oh, man, am I wearing my underoos? Like, I might be wearing my underoos still, right? Just the Maguire's enthusiasm. And going back to Raimi's camera, you know, Raimi has always had, I think we talked about Evil Dead at some point on the show, maybe for a Halloween themed episode. And I was a little cooler on it than most people are, just that the camera always had to be doing something. And what I like about Spider-Man is that he chooses the right moments for the camera to do something. And that whole sequence is where you get it. And then I'll just say it and we can dive into it later. Mm-hmm. I want to hear your scenes as well. But the upside down kiss, that's number one.
Yeah. So the last two you mentioned are my top two, and I have them just in reverse order. I'm going with the kiss, number two, the upside down kiss in the rain, and then number one, discovering his powers. And we can get into those a little more. I think I want to say up front here that we're going to be pretty comfortable spoiling this movie. We're going to assume that most of you listening have seen this film. And if you haven't, I'm not going to say 90% of our review is going to be spoilers, but still, you should maybe skip ahead until you have actually seen this movie. So do you want me to just go in order? Do you want me to give you five through three for me?
Yeah, run them down.
You didn't mention them, and they all get at different aspects of the film that I really appreciate. My number five, and this is one that you will not find on any list out there of the best Spider-Man scenes ever, but on rewatch just made me cackle almost the way Willem Dafoe cackles as the Green Goblin. It's the Thanksgiving scene where he's about to cut into the turkey, but then Aunt May sets down that casserole or whatever, and he can't help himself. Norman Osborn reaches his finger in to get a bite before it's served.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Aunt May admonishes him. So Aunt May admonishing an ornery Osborn is my number five. And I love it so much because of Defoe's response. The way he looks at her, which is with that devilish grin that suggests, not only am I a little bit unhappy that you did that, I actually want to jam this knife into you right now. Like, that is exactly what he is thinking at that moment. And it takes everything he has within him, playing the normal Norman, to restrain himself and not do it. And the way Raimi lingers on that. So we have to be in that space. And Aunt May is even kind of looking at him. Rosemary Harris, very good performance here as well, is looking at him and continues to kind of talk almost like this is a joke, right? But he doesn't really look like he's joking. And I think that scene is fantastic. And I think it does get at how good Defoe is in this film overall. Maybe tangent just for a second. You mentioned Raimi and you were excited about that at the time. I don't know if I was a good enough cinephile in 2002 to really think in those terms. In fact, I know I wasn't because I went back and looked at my review and I at least admitted that, you know, I had seen The Evil Dead once, but mostly watched it through my hands because it scared me so much as a junior high kid. And I definitely didn't feel like I could speak in any terms about Raimi as an auteur. So that was something that was lost on me completely back in 02. And this time you could see some of those horror elements really come through, including in those Green Goblin scenes where he is by himself talking to himself. Those are legitimately creepy. And it takes an actor of Defoe's caliber to make them work and to make them as sinister and creepy as they actually are. I also really like that scene, Josh, because that moment with Aunt May, and it closes with an exchange between Harry and Kirsten Dunst's Mary Jane as well. It gets at something this film is dealing with, which is masculinity. Something that definitely wasn't a prism I was watching movies through 20 years ago, but that look he gives Aunt May is a look he would give anybody who's sort of standing in his way of anything. But I think it's heightened by the fact that she's a woman.
Thanks for sticking up for me, Harry.
You heard?
Everyone heard that creep.
The creep is my father, all right? If I'm lucky, I'll become half of what he is. So just keep your mouth shut about stuff you don't understand.
Harry Osborn.
Very fair to call James Franco's Harry toxic, I
exactly.
think. I mean, how about when he's approving MJ's dress for
approving
meeting his
what
father?
She should wear.
Yeah. Worried about, you know, if he'll find her pretty. Yeah, there's a lot of nasty stuff like this in here.
There is. I mean, the movie is filled with bad guys. And I don't mean bad guys like villains, though there's villains here too. It's full of bad guys doing bad things. My number four is, here's where we really get into spoilers. It's the end, or that scene right before the final swing and the Empire State Building shot. It's the scene at the cemetery for Norman Osborn, and it's the choice Peter makes, which I, of course, completely remembered. I knew that that's how it ended, with this kind of crushing, oh, he wants her so badly, and now she wants him so badly, and is he actually going to say no? Is he actually going to do what he thinks he has to do, accepting his role, accepting his responsibility, and he's going to give up on happiness, he's going to give up on love, give up on MJ? And he does. And when he does, because we're invested enough in this story and these characters, when he does, it crushes you. But what I forgot is that touch as he walks away, where we get MJ's recognition that Peter is Spider-Man. And that's a case of the screenplay and the direction having it both ways, but I think in a really good, successful way.
Oh, yeah. And all set up by that kiss, right?
That's it. We understand his sacrifice. And since we see the movie through his eyes, we feel the weight of it. Like, we know something Spider-Man doesn't. And he will continue to go through life into that second film, not knowing what she knows. And so we'll continue to have that hanging over him. But the fact that we as an audience know that she really knows somehow does soften it, while also putting it back on her in a way. She has to maintain the secret, and she has to wrestle with why he's making that decision. So I love that choice, and specifically MJ's recognition. So then I'll get to here the last one before the two you mentioned. I think that bridge fight showdown is really spectacular. And it's another choice, right? Where Spider-Man has to make one, and he gets to have it both ways. He successfully, again, manages to save both all of those kids and all of those New Yorkers on the cable car, and he also gets to save MJ. But it's a moment that not only just has great action And despite there clearly being some CGI, this whole film uses practical effects and stunts to such good effect that nothing really about that sequence really feels false or artificial at all. And it keeps it contained. It's not just about chaos and destruction like these movies so often devolve into. And what I think that sequence also encapsulates is the DNA of superhero movies that came before it and that came after it. It gets it right. It's all there on the screen, where I'm sure most people were watching it and hearing his line where Defoe says something like, you know, if you're a hero, you're a good person, you're moral. At some point, a lunatic is going to force you into making a difficult choice. And I'm thinking about Heath Ledger's The Joker and The Dark Knight and the ships, you know, and I feel like that DNA, that blueprint, as I said, is there for those movies that came, but also many of those ones that came before. It has the sensibility of a Donner Superman and of Burton's Batman at times versus going for total realism. There is a sense of humor. There is a lightness to it, a sweetness. The camp factor is in play in some scenes and just the right amount, I would say. And while that's the big showdown that any of these action movies are leading to, how about the fact that the final brawl is just that? It's a mano-a-mano fight between two characters where you have a reveal. You know that Peter is now having to be responsible for, even though he doesn't actually commit it himself, be responsible for the death of a man he actually admires. And it's just hand-to-hand combat. It's not at all 4,000 characters on screen and you're trying to keep up with the action. And you feel it. You feel the intensity of that fight and the intimacy of it.
Yeah, if I prefer the one that you made as your pick, which I think is right, it's probably because it's free of the sort of, I mean, the thing I talk about when it comes to the MCU films, the punchplosions, right? They're punching each other through walls in that mano a mano. And I agree with you that it's personal. And so it works on that level. But what I really like about your pick sequence on the bridge is that it's a confrontation, but it's more about acrobatics and the choices you're talking about. And is he going to be able to hang on to this? Is he going to be able to spin around, you know, quickly enough? Those are the things that we're worried about. Not really how hard is this next punch going to be? Okay, how hard is the next punch going to be? Okay, how hard is the next punch going to be? You know, that's where a lot of superhero, and I would say more the DCEU films actually head this way, where we're just more invested in the brute strength. And that sequence you picked is about so many other things, which is why I think it's such a highlight.
Yeah, I agree. So then let's talk a little bit more about the two scenes you mentioned that are atop my list as well, because that upside down kiss in the rain is probably the most iconic moment from this film. And for good reason, it's enjoyable on some level cinematically, the same way all of these scenes we're discussing are. But in terms of what that scene expresses about what works about this film overall, yes, there is this sweetness that we've mentioned, the wholesomeness and innocence of this film overall. But think about this film and that relationship in comparison to the superhero movies we get today that are so, well, they're not only sexless, but they don't express anything that even resembles any sexual heat. There is no sensuality to these films whatsoever. And here we absolutely get it. It doesn't shy away from Kirsten Dunst's character playing MJ as probably the quote unquote hottest girl in school. And in a way that doesn't make it, to this male anyway, feel too male gazy. You know, she's thirsting for Spider-Man. She makes the moves. She makes the move with Peter. She's in control. And back to the masculinity point, when she's mistreated by Harry, when she hears the conversation between Harry and Norman and he doesn't defend her at all, she calls him out on it. But there's sensuality in the exchange you mentioned, that line, that's all subtext for the actual heat that is starting to emerge between these two people. That great bit of dialogue you mentioned where he says that he hunches and she tells him not to. You know what's starting to come through there. And then in that kiss, it's a hot kiss. We get nothing like that in any other superhero movie of recent vintage I can think of, Josh.
Well, Adam, that's because you missed the Eternals, where, or just Eternals, I think I should say, where, you know, Marvel really, really moved into that. No, I'm just joking. It's there is a sex scene, but it is kind of doesn't really work. Yes, you're right about the hotness of it. And it's something that I wondered watching it this time is if this came from a comic book, you know, was this an image that was well known to Spider-Man fans? Was it invented for the movie? Was it in the script? So did a little Googling, and actually The Ringer just published something today. I was reading at lunch, so this was perfect. Works out great for us. It's by Jake Kring Schrieffels, not sure how to pronounce that, but basically When Mary Jane Kissed Spider-Man is what it's titled. We'll link to it in the show notes because there's so many great details here, but just briefly, turns out the basic idea came from Doug Leffler, who was the movie's second unit director and storyboard artist. He had staged scenes with characters upside down in his previous work as a TV director. So not necessarily kisses, but just this idea of having two characters in the frame, one of them upside down. So Leffler presented some sketches to Raimi. Raimi loved it. And then producer Laura Ziskin actually is the one who suggested the crucial element of having MJ pull down his mask just enough to reveal the lips. Mm-hmm. So all of that comes together to make this moment that I agree is legitimately iconic. And again, we'll link to that in the show notes on The Ringer, but it's wonderful in so many ways. The ones you described, I like how it just uses the mask and you can sense that it's a real mask. You know, there's no CGI mm-hmm. here either on his face. It's something that is actually wet that has to be pulled down. I think that adds a lot to it. Going back to my Naperville Sun review, you know I'm skeptical about puns, Adam, but I did pull one out. I think this was me. Might have been our great JJ, our great copy desk chief, but Swinging in the Rain. Not bad, right? Mm. The headline for my review in 2002.
Yeah, and you...
Pretty proud of that
one. You're okay with puns and titles, right? Or headlines?
Titles and headlines. That's what you save them for.
You have a knack for getting in trouble.
You have a knack for saving my life. I think I have a superhero stalker.
I was in the neighborhood.
You are amazing.
Some people don't think so.
But you are.
Nice to have a fan.
Do I get to say thank you this time?
Wait.
So, yeah, this is a wonderful moment, and it makes me think of a question I want to get your take on. Do you think it was smart? It sounds like you do, and maybe you don't see it this way, but for this Spider-Man to frame itself first and foremost as a romance. So rather than an action movie, rather even than an origin story, you know, you have that opening voiceover. We're told this is about a girl. That's what this is about. Yeah. We get so many scenes to their developing relationship and chemistry. Sounds like you're with me agreeing that Maguire and Dunst are very good, especially together. And you already talked about that note it ends on. It's all about she doesn't know, but she does. And she knows that because of the kiss. So you're with me. It sounds like that was a good move, is to kind of frame it that way.
I mean, I think it's what ultimately does make the movie special. It's why we're still talking about it 20 years later. It's not because it gets the action right, though that's part of it. It's not that it's fun and all of these elements that we've been discussing. It's part of it. But I think really at its core, it's because we respond to those characters so much and we respond to that central love story. But overall, I think that's also indicative of what generally works about this movie. And you touched on it a little bit earlier. It is that it is self-contained. That's the right word for it. It does have some intimacy in a lot of these scenes. You do feel as if all of the action revolves around these four or five central characters, though ironically, it's also a movie that gets right the fact that it takes place in New York and you feel as if there are real people living lives in the city. In contrast to, I'll say it, and I like many of these Marvel movies. We say this all the time. We've reviewed some of them very favorably on the show, but they have so many characters in it, and there's so much going on that you don't really ever get the sense that they exist in a real world, you know, or that there's stakes that affect real people. It tries to build that and oftentimes succeeds in the relationships between those characters, but not on the scale that a movie like this Spider-Man does. And the fact that you've got just this universe of characters, everything that's happening from a plot standpoint, from a story standpoint, from a thematic standpoint, all ties back to the characters and characters that you either care about or are really curious about. And they all have depth to them. I mean, yes, this is a movie about a teen-ish grappling with changes and grappling with responsibility and what it means to be a man. But he's also, at the end of the day, protecting the people he loves and the city he loves from a bad guy. And even that bad guy is someone that he has a personal connection to. So I think that heart is at the heart of what makes Spider-Man so good.
So should we turn to your favorite, the getting to know his powers, getting to learn his powers sequence?
Yeah.
Because for me,
that's it.
I think what this does, it sort of combines two of the great things about the movie. It's Raimi's skills as a filmmaker and Maguire's abilities as a performer for this part in particular. I talked about the camera work, and how about the movement as Peter starts crawling up that brick wall in the alley, right? We're looking down at him, and it kind of just slides alongside of him and then watches him. It's a perfect example of waiting for your moment and then really going for it and putting us in that experience. And then even when we get, you know, Spider-Man swinging around, and it's a little more clumsy as it should be in these opening sequences, I like the patience Raimi has for widescreen compositions for a lot of the action.
Yeah.
This isn't edited to death, right? And you get a little bit of that here. I think you get more of it as Peter's more confident in his abilities, and we're just kind of taking in the skyline that he's swinging through without having to have it be chopped up in so many edits. So I like Raimi's camera work and filmmaking prowess here, but also Maguire. I mean, he, you know, is it just nostalgia that I think he's the best Spider-Man we have? I really like Tom Holland, you know, Andrew Garfield, that those films just, they never quite worked for me. And as much as I like him as an actor, it didn't seem like the greatest fit. But Maguire here gets the nerdiness down, which I think is the most important quality for this character. I love his froggy smile when he doesn't open his mouth, and it just kind of like starts spreading, but he's not going to fully commit because there it's that little bit of insecurity that he brings. And going back to your pick, this enthusiasm he has for his powers, just the excitement he's expressing, the fun. How fun would it be to be Spider-Man? No one ever really thought it would be fun to be Batman when you were a kid. You know, it seemed maybe the TV show. Okay, yeah, utility belt, pretty cool. But, you know, the comic Batman, the more intense, traumatized Batman. Spider-Man seemed like it would be great fun. And that's what Maguire taps into in this opening sequence, or this early sequence, I should say.
Yeah, for sure. I remember having that same feeling you described in the theater when I saw it in 2002. And I had a similar feeling watching it again. And I think it's for all the reasons that you express. I'll also say that it's another one of those scenes that gets back to the point about the DNA of what attracts us to superhero movies in the first place and what the best ones do and do well. It makes me think of Donner's Superman in particular and a younger Clark Kent discovering his powers and having some fun running along the train, kicking the football, doing some of those different things that he does. We see that here in the scene with Peter Parker. And the montage, I'll get away from the scene a little bit, but it follows pretty quickly as he starts to accept his responsibility. That montage of him thwarting various crimes, that's something you see in Batman 2. You probably see in every superhero movie, at least every origin story to an extent. But here you've got that playfulness about it. As Sophie said, unlike watching the Batman movies, and she likes those Nolan movies too, but it never feels like a drag. In fact, it feels really fun as you watch those scenes here. And I think this is the most fun scene in the film. And I think at its core, to go back to where we started, it's the scene that encapsulates everything that drew us to Spider-Man in the first place as kids. It is both the fantasy and the imagination part, the part where he gets to do things above and beyond his normal capabilities, but it also has him failing. It has him learning. It has him having to figure things out. And so that same part of us where, you know, you were climbing on the stairs a certain way. You probably fell. You know, you're climbing up the side of the stairs. Your mom told you not to, but you think you're being just like Spider-Man.
What are you doing? Get down.
Yeah. The first time you fall, just like he does here, right? But then you figure it out, and in your mind, you're Spider-Man. It's all there.
It's so right. All right. So one more thing for sure I wanted to touch on, just because there was so much talk about turning red, you know, and female adolescence and puberty. Oh, yeah. And are we really going to have a movie about menstruation? I can't, you know, a lot of people, including us, I think, appreciated that sort of honesty and that freshness. And other people were like, I can't believe this is happening in a movie for kids. I mean, this thing as a puberty parable is pretty incredible, right? Uncle Ben mentioning very early on hormones, teenagers, to Aunt May, Peter alone in his room dealing with sticky substances. And it goes beyond the physical changes, right? It also marks the relationship, the relational changes that happen during those years. A really sort of, and again, this is probably because I'm an older parent at this point, but how about the moment where he and Uncle Ben are, you know, they clearly have a good connection here together. Yes. And Cliff Robertson is Uncle Ben, of course, wonderful performance. And they are talking about painting when he comes home from school. We're going to paint, I think it's the kitchen or whatever, right? Sure thing. That is what the afternoon he discovers his powers and goes on the exact sequence we were just talking about. That's the joyride. That's taking out the car with your friends, forgetting what you promised the person in your life who
your responsibility
cares about you, who cares about you, right? And to me, it was just like, oh, and then what do you get? The note about his supper is still, you know, no like waiting for him to come home and screaming him out, just a note, your supper is still waiting for you. And you don't get the sense it's like a guilt trip thing either. It's they wanted to make sure he ate. So all of that, I think, is tied into this as a puberty parable, is just charting, you know, some nods to the physical changes, but also noticing the relational element as well.
Yeah, well, even the last thing he says to him, his rebuke, is something you can imagine that he never probably said to him before and wouldn't have said to him prior. He's accepted him as his father his entire life. And yet post-change, as he's dealing with this, and post his transformation, now he's standing up to him, if you will, and saying, well, you're not my father, and gets out of the car. So that relationship element between the adults, between the parents in this case and the son, is very much at play. I do think it's something that works about the film. I don't think it's a big shock either. If you recall, I think that Raimi deals with, to go back to Turning Red, menstruation as a very dominant metaphor. All the blood that's happening in Evil Dead, he's playing with similar ideas in that film as he is here in Spider-Man. But you're right, the fact that moment where he says, don't come in, I'm not dressed, and then he turns around and there's webs everywhere. I mean, that's hilarious. And the fact that he's generating these substances by himself, the verses, and of course they talk about this in No Way Home, the fact that he can produce that substance on his own versus it being something that he has to actually manufacture. I do like that touch for all the reasons that you articulated. There's still a part of me too that kind of puts that in the funny camp factor of the film as well, because as I alluded to earlier, he's 18 or something, right? Like, he's about to graduate high school.
Well,
and they talk about him like he's 14 and he's just going through it.
Well, we're definitely still in the era of like clearly 38-year-olds playing teenagers when it comes to like Flash in the bullying scenes.
Yeah, Joe Manganiello. That's Joe Manganiello in his first ever screen performance.
Wow.
Unrecognizable.
I did not catch that. Yeah, you're wondering if Flash is Flash like his classmate, or is it Grandparents' Day? Not quite sure.
Exactly. Well, we obviously had fun with Spider-Man, and if you have seen the film recently, it's available to rent on most platforms. You may also find a 2002-era DVD at your local library. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
So what does a Sam Raimi superhero movie look like 20 years after Spider-Man? I'll have a brief review of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness when we come back, plus results of the latest film spotting poll and a preview of the Chicago Critics Film Festival. Stay with us.
That's Elizabeth Olsen's Scarlet Witch in the trailer for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. I didn't make the screening for this one, Josh, but you did, and we both liked the first Doctor Strange, which came out back in 2016. The director of that first entry, Scott Derrickson, had a background in horror and brought the MCU into some new directions. He didn't return for the sequel, but the guy who took his place knows a thing or two about horror and superhero movies. Yes, it's Sam Raimi. How do you think he did with this Doctor Strange sequel? And can you actually tell me what the hell this movie is about anyway?
I mean, we do not have time for that. Film Spotting, even, believe it or not, does not have time for that, Adam. So let's just skip right over that. And I'll say I probably appreciated this on the same level as I did the original Doctor Strange. I haven't added it to my MCU ranked list yet on Letterboxd. I would probably call it mid-tier Marvel. I will say this about it. The reason we're doing this show, Sam Raimi, is the reason Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is good. It's very much, it takes a little while, but even more so than Spider-Man, it becomes really clear that this is a Sam Raimi movie, and that's what I got a kick out of. And I'm not going to detail exactly how, because it would be giving too much away. So I'll just say the references that are made here that fit within the context of this story. We get some nods to Carrie. We get, you mentioned the goblins, the Green Goblins in Spider-Man, kind of evoking the horror elements. How about when he throws that one bomb and it vaporizes his victims so they look like skeletons first? Remember that moment?
Yeah.
We get some similar stop motion imagery influenced by Ray Harryhausen, you know, that Raimi has done in a number of his films. We get some of that here. And there is a zombie twist to this movie that had me delighted way more than the handful of reveals about future MCU products that I'm not going to give away, obviously. Those got a lot of reaction from the crowd. For me, it was the zombie element where I was like, oh yeah, we've gone full Raimi here. So there are possessions, there are exorcisms. You know, this is the guy who made, what was it, Drag Me to Hell, right? That was kind of one of his mid-career forays back into full-on horror. You get all of that within what is a somewhat obligatory MCU installment. As you said in our Spider-Man review, largely overall, we are both fans of these movies. I think we would both agree more of them work than don't, but they can feel a bit pedestrian. And in terms of plot, this is probably along those lines. You will need, maybe not need, it will be helpful to have a fair amount of knowledge about the MCU streaming series WandaVision with Elizabeth Olsen to, I wouldn't say to understand this plot, but to have one thread, the emotional thread of it, really resonate with you. Because if you're just told why it matters because you've gone into this movie cold, it's not really going to matter. If you've seen that series as I did, you can understand it. So that's kind of that's the trick to this whole enterprise, right? Of not only the cinematic universe, but the televised universe now too, is if you have to be bought in 185% for it to matter, is that fair? I don't have a total answer to it. I can tell you if I hadn't watched that series, I would think that Multiverse of Madness is even thinner than I do, for whatever that is worth. But yeah, for the Raimi bits, well worth your time.
The Raimi bits. Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is currently open in wide release. If you disagree or agree with Josh, we'd love to hear from you. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Josh, at long last, we can plug our big Film Spotting Live event. It's happening.
Can't believe it's happening. I mean, it's been, you know, our anniversary tour was canceled from the pandemic, and so we haven't had a chance to do a live show in 2 years. But now, this June, we're going to be back on stage with listeners, hanging out with listeners, watching a great movie, and getting to talk to Dana Stevens.
Yeah, and that's always a treat in and of itself. And it's one that instead of us just doing talking to her in studio or over Skype or Zoom, we actually get to do it live with an audience. Sunday, June 5th at the Music Box here in Chicago, we're going to conclude our Buster Keaton Marathon. Dana, of course, the author of Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. She will be in attendance with us at the Music Box. The Cameraman is going to include live accompaniment with an original score by Music Box organist Dennis Scott. Can't wait for that, Josh. And yes, there is a VIP opportunity pre-show, just like we did for our Rio Bravo event 2.5 years ago-ish. Feels like 12 and a half years ago-ish. Pre-show meet and greet. Hang out with Dana, with me, with you, Josh, our producer, Sam, other venerated guests of Film Spotting, friends of the show like Michael Phillips will be there, Mariah Gates will be there, Brian Tallarico will be there, and others. Keith Phipps from The Next Picture Show is another guest who will be there. You get to hang out with us. You get to have some free popcorn. You get a drink in the lounge for free. You get to then have priority seating for the screening and podcast taping, because we're going to watch The Cameraman, the final film in our marathon. Then we're going to talk about it a little bit with Dana, and then we're going to share our Keaton Awards live.
A little extra pressure for these awards compared to others, you know, not only having Dana weigh in on them. We've done that on air on occasion with specialists in a field, but to be doing all that before a live audience, you know, I don't want to make a really boneheaded pick that she shakes her head at. So we'll see where we land. But Dana's great. I'm sure she would be gracious no matter what. But yeah, having read the book, it's fantastic. Her insights on Buster Keaton are incredible. And as anyone who has heard her on the show or on the Slate Culture Gabfest, they know she's wonderful as a podcaster as well. So really excited about a chance to hang out with her before a live audience.
So if you want tickets, you can go to either of these two places and you can buy either of the passes that you would like. You can go to filmspotting.net. There's a link right there on our main page. Or you can go to filmspotting.net/events. That's where you can purchase the VIP passes. But there's also a link over to the Music Box and their website if you just want the screening tickets. You just want to come watch the screening and hear the podcast taping afterwards. Oh, we didn't mention Dana's going to sign copies of the book afterwards there at the Music Box. But if you just want that experience, you can buy a ticket via the Music Box. If you want the VIP experience, you can go to filmspotting.net/events. But again, you'll find links to whatever ticket you want to buy in either location, our website or the Music Box's website. And if you go to this episode page on our website, we will put links there.
Eddie Adams from Torrance. I knew you'd make it. Take the bus all the way here?
Yeah.
It wasn't bad, though. Oh, great. I got some people I want you to meet.
Our Buster Keaton screening with Dana Stevens is not the only big event coming up at the Music Box here in Chicago. You just heard a clip from Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, which somehow turns 25 this year. To honor that anniversary, the film is getting a special 35mm screening as part of this year's Chicago Critics Film Festival. It's all happening at the Music Box May 13th through the 19th. And here to tell us more about the fest, as he is wont to do annually here on Film Spotting, it's our friend Steve Procopi. Steve, how are you?
I'm good. It's been actually, this is the first time since 2019, believe it or not,
that I've
come on and talked about the festival. But I'm not just saying this because I'm promoting it. I think this is legitimately our best lineup overall. So I'm very, very happy with what we pulled together.
Well, I was going to kind of chide you about that a little bit, because I feel like every year you, Brian Tallarico, the other critics that put together this fest and this lineup of great films, you always say it's our best one yet. But you're probably telling the truth. It seems that way, that it gets better every year.
I mean, there are always one or two in there that, like, I'll just like, okay, well, I didn't vote for that one. This year, I am in favor of every single title that we have scheduled. So I am proud to say that.
Well, let me ask you about that, Steve, because it's true. I mean, the lineups have always been impressive pretty much since the start of this festival. So I'm wondering if there is some sort of philosophical approach that has led to that. Is there, you know, is it a matter of just keeping an eye on festivals that occur earlier and getting the cream of the crop? Is it looking for particular filmmakers that you know always deliver? Is it wanting to create some sort of experience unique to this festival? But as the team is putting together the lineup, I don't know, how does that work? You have proven yourselves at this point. Absolutely. So I really want to know some of the behind the scenes mechanics to get to that.
I mean, we have a system. We've added a few programmers over the years. Most recently, we added Robert Daniels, who is with multiple outlets at this point.
Yep.
But he's a new member as of last year. I mean, the philosophy for me, it might be different for other people, but the philosophy for me has always been, this is going to be a film that maybe some people wouldn't gravitate to normally in their normal movie going experiences. Now, a lot of the people that come to our festival, maybe it would, but I've always called this a trust me festival. And this is us basically asking the people that love movies, that love doing festivals, to just trust us on these. They will not be disappointed. They might not like everything. They will probably understand why we programmed it. There's a lot of angst this year in these some of these titles. So we're going to mess with your head. We're going to make you feel very uncomfortable and awkward. We're also going to entertain the hell out of you. There's some real, just some great stuff this year. Some of the best performances I have seen all year are in this collection of films.
Well, we are going to talk more about some of these titles, but I also understand that maybe you have a little bit of news to break. You have an announcement you want to share here on Film Spotting?
Yes, but by the time this airs, the news will be out there, but technically you are hearing it first.
We'll take it.
We have a movie. Our closing night film is a film called I Love My Dad. It's something we all saw at South by Southwest. It's from a writer-director named James Morosini, who also is one of the stars of the film, and it's supposedly a true story about an event that happened between him and his dad. And his dad in the film is played by Patton Oswalt. He catfishes his son into thinking that he is this very pretty girl because his son is very depressive and suicidal, played by Morosini. And when we announced the full lineup, Morosini was announced as being one of our guests. But we just confirmed today that Patton Oswalt will also be at the screening now. So if the screening was already selling pretty briskly, it is probably going to sell out now. So people who are interested in seeing Patton Oswalt should probably get their tickets sooner rather than later.
Okay, good stuff. Let's talk about some of the other titles that you are most excited about. I know you're excited about every one of them, but give us a few of the highlights for you, Steve.
Well, I mean, just to bookend it, I think the opening night film is a film that played both Sundance and South by Southwest called Cha-Cha Real Smooth from writer-director Cooper Rafe, who also will be at the screening. This is Friday, May 13th at 7 o'clock. It's about a guy who was sort of fresh out of college, strikes up a relationship with a young mother and her teenage daughter. The mother is played by Dakota Johnson. It's not quite a love story, but it is sort of a love story. And it's just a magnificent film. I think it's the best thing I've seen Dakota Johnson do in her career. And that's coming off of the Lost Daughter. I mean, I thought she was great in that. And I think she's even better here. There's some really nice supporting work from Leslie Mann and Brad Garrett in this. It's a film about family. It's a film about this very interesting relationship between this mother and daughter and this guy who's still growing up. It's sort of a coming of age story in a lot of ways. It's a beautiful little film. We're very, very excited we got it to open the festival and that Cooper Rafe is coming in. So,
yeah, great, great debut film from him that was a Golden Brick contender here on Film Spotting Shithouse.
Yes. I wasn't sure if I was allowed to say Shithouse, so okay. I guess I can.
You're allowed. Give us another title.
Go for it, and we can't say what might happen to you, so.
That's all right. One film we always are trying very hard to find some of the best documentaries we can. We have a great one called Hold Your Fire, which I think eventually is going to end up on Showtime playing Sunday, May 15th at 7:15. The filmmaker, a guy named Stefan Forbes, is going to be there in attendance. It basically is about the incident that birthed the modern day hostage negotiation practice. Brooklyn in 1973, I believe it's right in the sort of the shadow of Attica. And a lot of the people on both sides of this negotiation are still alive. So they have new interviews with most of the major players in this incident. And it's fascinating. And it's a little scary to watch sometimes because this was in the wake of Attica, where pretty much every negotiating tactic went wrong. If you saw the documentary Attica that was on Showtime last year, it's a perfect companion piece to it. And it's a tense, it's like, I didn't really know how this was going to end. I didn't know this story. So it is tense. It is dramatic storytelling at its best in the documentary form.
There's another documentary I'm really intrigued by because it's the doc debut of filmmaker Ramin Barani.
Mm-hmm. Second Chance. Yes, that's another one from Sundance. That's a terrific, terrific film. I dare you to watch the trailer because the first thing that happens in the trailer is a guy in a bulletproof vest shoots himself in the chest. It's a guy named Richard Davis who invented what is essentially the modern day bulletproof vest. So it's about his career. And obviously, if it was just about a guy who made bulletproof vests, it wouldn't be much of a movie. This guy has a shady as hell story to tell. There's a very fascinating story about this guy who's basically living the American dream and then sabotages himself, as we find out he does, has many times in his life. So yeah, Ramin Barani, it took me a while to see the connection between this film and many of his other films about the American dream from a certain angle, or the American dream gone very poorly for some people. It's a terrific movie called Second Chance. And that's playing Sunday, May 15th at noon. So it'll be the first film that day.
Claire Denis, another big name who I don't believe will be attending the fest.
No.
That would be something. But she has a film playing the fest.
Yeah, when we saw it, it was called Fire. But now it's called Both Sides of the Blade. And it stars her recent favorite actress, Juliette Binoche, as well as Vincent London, who was just in Titan recently and just killed it in that movie. And he's also very good here. But that's happening. Actually, that's going to be right after the Ramin Barani film. That'll be Sunday, May 15th at 2 p.m. So that's an excellent double feature.
Yeah, that's the afternoon I have circled on my calendar largely for the Denis. And I know I'm not in for a comfortable viewing, but I will definitely be challenged and am always open to what she has ready to throw my way.
I can recommend one of the films I've seen that's playing the fest. It's one of those films playing on the last day, I think on Thursday. That's Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, has a really wonderful performance by Emma Thompson that, let's just say, I think a lot of people will be talking about.
Oh, definitely. And honestly, like the male, it's a two person film. Like it's basically just the two of, it's Emma Thompson and this guy named Daryl McCormick. They are wonderful together. And I've never seen him before, but he's a male prostitute that she hires. She's a widow, a retired school teacher. And she is just trying to figure out what good sex even could be, whether let alone if she can actually experience or not. And I honestly think the reaction to this film is going to really depend on what you bring to it. I think it's going to really just in your relationship to sex. So yeah, and you're right. It's a wonderful film. I can easily see Emma Thompson being talked about at the end of the year awards season. So it's that good. And she's tremendous in it. And I can honestly say, I don't think I've ever seen her the way you see her here. So
no, that is for sure. Unless there's something that I have dramatically overlooked, Steve. The Chicago Critics Film Festival runs May 13th through the 19th. It does take place at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago. And you can get more info and tickets at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com. Thank you, Steve, as always, for your insights on the films and for putting together the fest, being part of that.
But thanks, I hope to see everybody there. Thank you so much.
We want to thank members of the Film Spotting family on Patreon for supporting this episode of Film Spotting.
Thanks to our new patrons, including Ben Kreiss, Trent in Portland, and Scott in Tampa. Every new Film Spotting family member helps us inch closer to our increasingly quixotic goal of 900 new Patreon supporters before our 900th episode. Josh, it's coming fast. The clock is ticking away. I don't know that we're going to make it, but if we did, listeners would get movie commentaries from us.
Yeah, we made some good progress the last month, I would say. And we'll see if that keeps going. Yeah, we're both going to have to pick out a movie, which one we're going to give some commentary to. If you do join the family on Patreon, you will get ad-free episodes and merch discounts. You'll also get, and it's such a thrill to be able to say we actually applied this now, Adam, pre-sales on live events. Family
with
members indeed had, with a discount, early access to our June 5 Buster Keaton show with Dana Stevens. We also, of course, offer family members opportunities to play live monthly trivia. We're going to gather next to do that in June. And then, yes, every month you get a bonus show from us. In April, we recorded a review of Broadcast News, a blind cow review. That film, A Sacred Cow for You, Adam. I had never seen it, so I did a little blind spotting. And I think in May, we're talking about doing some more Ask Us Anything. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that sounds right. Whatever you got, throw it our way. feedback@filmspotting.net. Use Ask Us Anything in the subject line, and maybe we'll address it on a future bonus show. To become a family member or for more info, visit patreon.com/filmspotting.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
I have one question, Dr. Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein.
I beg your pardon?
My name, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
But aren't you the grandson of the famous Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who went into graveyards, dug up freshly buried corpses, and transformed dead components into...
Yes, yes, yes. We all know what he did. But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science, and not because of my accidental relationship to a famous...
cuckoo.
Gene Wilder, of course, and Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein. It was the new Doctor Strange that inspired the latest Film Spotting poll question, which asked, in all seriousness, what is your favorite film about a movie doctor that isn't really about them being a doctor? It's the hard-hitting questions that everyone tunes in for. Josh, they're really...
Didn't they do a segment on that on Broadcast News?
I think. Your options were... 1935's Bride of Frankenstein, 1935's Captain Blood. Been a while since we've had two 1935 options in a poll question. How about jumping up to 2016, Doctor Strange, Benedict Cumberbatch as Dr. Stephen Strange, of course, or Dr. Zhivago, starring Omar Sharif. What about Tom Cruise as Dr. Bill Harford in Eyes Wide Shut from Stanley Kubrick, or Dr. Richard Kimball, Harrison Ford in The Fugitive? Finally, you could pick Gene Wilder as Frederick Frankenstein from Young Frankenstein. Josh, how did it play out?
Well, in last place is Sam's beloved Captain Blood. You know what, though, Sam, your work here is done. You brought more attention to Captain Blood, which I wholeheartedly agree it needs. So even though it was in last place, that's okay. 3% of the vote there actually packed up pretty tightly here at the bottom. 4% of the vote for Doctor Strange, 5% for Dr. Zhivago, and 6% for Bride of Frankenstein. A little tighter with the top three. With 21% of the vote, Eyes Wide Shut. Second place goes to The Fugitive with 27%, but that means Young Frankenstein did win it with 33% of the vote.
A third of the vote, not too shabby. Marco says, I pick Young Frankenstein simply because it is one of my all-time faves, a comedy classic that stands up to infinite rewatches. But then I started thinking, isn't Gene Wilder's character an actual doctor? I mean, he does give extremely erudite lectures to medical students, not to mention his groundbreaking work in reanimating corpses. Another flawed Film Spotting poll. Oh, I think that ship has sailed. I think we've acknowledged many a time how deeply flawed this question is.
More questions here from Maddie Rosen. Pick this nit, but both Frankenstein movies are literally about the life-restoring medical research of their protagonists.
I voted Eyes Wide Shut. In addition to it being a great film, Dr. Harford's journey of sexual conquest, in which he never actually has any sex, mirrors the question quite nicely.
Okay, here's Andy Bucati from Kansas City. Since the rules unfortunately prevent me from voting for the Dr. J starring The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh, the definitive movie about the crossroads of basketball and astrology, I'll have to go with The Fugitive as my favorite movie of this bunch. We're going to do that top five at some point, the top five movies at the crossroads of basketball and astrology. I'm not sure
Can't
I can
wait.
Name a performance by an actor whose choices in what could be forgettable line readings elevate a movie more than Tommy Lee Jones here. I don't care. Shouldn't be so memorable. And Andy, to your point, even just a minute ago, maybe people couldn't detect my Tommy Lee Jones impression, but I was saying Dr. Richard Kimball the same way he does, because there's something about Tommy Lee Jones giving a good line reading that I can't resist.
I didn't kill my wife. I don't care.
I heard a little bit of it there in your don't care.
Thank
we
you.
Also heard from Andrea Weaver. How could it be anything but The Fugitive? Nothing beats Harrison Ford trying to outwit Tommy Lee Jones. I saw this movie for the first time when I was very young and never forgot it. I admit that my choice may be influenced by my childhood fear of a one-armed man mixed with the nostalgia of my first grown-up movie, but I'm more inclined to believe that it's the exceptional storyline and acting. Either way, Dr. Kimball is the best movie doctor doing not-so-doctory things, and I challenge anyone, including the U.S. Marshals, to disagree.
Oh, you don't want that fight. Edwin Arnoden, as much as I enjoy the Frankenstein options and The Fugitive, only one of these options is directed by Stanley Kubrick. Concise?
Mm.
I like it.
Always a good factor to consider. We heard from Dylan Dom as well. I will come in support of Dr. Zhivago. While it's long and meandering, and I can't remember most of what happens, I wish we still got big movies like this that seem to take a whole week to finish. This was David Lean at the height of his powers, and while this film may have been a bit too excessive, when it hit hard, including one of the most heartbreaking movie endings ever. And who hasn't had Lara's theme stuck in their head a couple dozen times?
Here's Beverly Lieberman. Last couple comments here. I decided to go with my heart and my childhood love for Swashbucklers. I voted for Captain Blood because I've always had a soft spot for Errol Flynn. He's a perfect romantic lead. Handsome, charming, willing and able to deal with the circumstances, and his scenes with Olivia de Havilland are to swoon for.
Captain Blood, really good. Our last comment comes from Brian Friesen. Dr. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs is another option that came to mind. Although he does perform surgery on a policeman's face at one point in the
film. Yeah, let's not talk about it. How about we just move on? Thanks, Brian. Let's move on to our new deeply flawed film spotting poll. I don't know. Is this one possible for this one to be flawed? I'm sure if anybody could find a way, it's our producer, Sam, and it's on our listeners to point out those flaws. We're looking ahead to our summer movie preview that could come next week, or it might be the following week. We still got some details here to work out with the schedule behind the scenes on film spotting. But while we're working those out, we've got a straightforward film spotting poll. There's only two options. What is your most anticipated film of the summer movie season? Josh, the choices are.
Yep, it's Nope. Or Nope, it's something else.
So did everybody listening follow that?
I can't see this causing any problems whatsoever.
Nope.
Any confusion. This will be very easy, simple. We'll have no complaints.
Yeah. It's either Jordan Peele's Nope or Nope, it's something else. And if you're not voting for Nope, we want to know what is your most anticipated film of the summer. You can write it in the comments. We may feature it here on the show in the coming weeks. I mean, we've got new films from Cronenberg, Claire Denis, Terrence Davies. I don't really care about Jurassic World, but how about Top Gun Maverick?
How about it?
That's the reason, Josh, that I can't vote for Nope. I'm going Nope with something else. It's Maverick.
Good luck with that. We also have Baz Luhrmann's Elvis movie and
pass.
I don't know how. Yeah, I know you're giving up. Never been a fan, probably. I don't know how this ended up on the list, but apparently there's an Adam Sandler basketball movie called Hustle that has went. I mean, talk about whiplash for the Sandler experience. It went from being the potential penalty for the loser in our in-house film spotting prediction poll for Film Spotting Madness to suddenly being an option for a most anticipated movie of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite an adventure.
I know. And yet it does seem like it might be good enough. It's not going to be the punishment for Mike Merrigan this year, our Film Spotting Madness loser. Who knows? Maybe even it'll get a review on the show. When was the last Sandler movie that got a review on the show other than Uncut Gems?
Yeah, that's got to be it, right?
You can vote in that poll now and leave a comment at filmspotting.net.
So, you want to join the internet's scariest online horror game? We can't be held responsible for what you become. All you have to do to get started is take the challenge.
I don't know what to expect. I want to go to the World's Fair. I want to go to the World's Fair. I want to go to the World's Fair.
Okay, Josh. Busy guy last week, fitting in all the movies. You not only saw the new Doctor Strange, you also caught up with a movie you want to nominate for the Golden Brick Award. It's called We're All Going to the World's Fair, the feature debut of filmmaker Jane Schoenbrunn, and it debuted at last year's Sundance, currently available to rent on most platforms. In your Letterboxd review, you described it as the nightmare version of Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade. That movie scared me enough, so I don't know what to make of We're All Going to the World's Fair. Give us some thoughts. Why is it a Golden Brick potential contender?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that doesn't mean to imply Eighth Grade was sunny. I think it leaned sunny, though, and this leans despairing. You could almost maybe qualify it as a horror movie, actually. And the similarity to Eighth Grade is that it basically follows a teenager named Casey, played by Anna Cobb, who is very, very good. She seems very lonely. As far as we know, no friends in her life. Her father, who she seems to be the only person she lives with, is an off-screen sort of threatening presence. She is online all the time. So there's a similarity, right, with Eighth Grade. And at the beginning of the movie, this really engrossing fixed shot from the vantage point of her webcam, she joins this online horror game. And the game supposedly instigates these strange transformations in its players. Casey goes on to document this, or it's never quite clear, maybe invents what's happening to her in videos that then she makes and uploads on the internet. So it goes in a little different direction from Eighth Grade from there. And I think for me, it's going to, depending on, you know, where you are generationally and your relationship with the internet, it's going to hit you differently. For me, as someone who did not grow up with this sort of stuff, it was this eye-opening but incisive, from what I can remember from being that age, really deep dive into adolescent alienation, and then considers how that may be accentuated by the internet. But this isn't like an internet fear factor thing. You know, it's almost like people who have a deep need for community and connection now have this tool for seeking it that can in some ways be good, but in other ways be really destructive and harmful. So that's why it's sort of the horror vision, the nightmare version, I should say. But in terms of being, you know, a Golden Brick contender, it's a lot about the filmmaking and Schoenbrunn's, just their approach to capturing another generational thing is that teenagers are sort of online teenagers, I should say. They're necessarily filmmakers, right? They have to be. They have to be aware of adjusting lighting in their bedrooms, which Casey does. And she has these day glow decals that add this psychedelic effect. She puts her laptop at one point on a swivel chair to achieve just the right angle for recording herself while she sleeps. These are all filmmaking choices that she is making as a character, but are also reflected in what Schoenbrunn is making as a filmmaker. So that sort of stuff fascinated me. I'm very eager to, now that I've kind of watched it and had my take, I know it's been out for a little while in theaters and is now on digital, but to follow up with other people and get their impressions on where this goes, because there is a lot of ambiguity towards the end of the movie. I'll just say, without spoiling anything, that Casey does get connected with this mysterious figure named JLB, who... that's all I'm going to say. Basically, there is one other person she connects with that we're never quite totally sure how to feel with and how to feel about, I should say. And the movie is ambiguous right up to its end on that point, which I'm still kind of wondering about. I can't wait to hear from other people if they like that or if it left them hanging a little bit. For me, I think it was because I did feel so... just attached to this extremely lonely, extremely disaffected teenager who is seeking connection and meaning on the internet and is winding up in a place that, from all we can tell, is not really providing that. So definitely Golden Brick worthy consideration for that award and something people should check out. Thankfully, now it should be pretty widely available via streaming. And with that, Adam, we are done with the show. If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, you can do that at Film Spotting and at Larson on Film. In the show archives over at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. You can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll, which looks ahead to our summer movie preview. We're asking, what summer movie are you most anticipating? Jordan Peele's Nope or Nope, something else? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in wide release this weekend, all we got is Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, and while you weren't enthusiastic in your praise for it, Josh, sounds like it's one you think that's worth seeing, mainly because of the director, Sam Raimi.
Yeah, Raimi fans will definitely want to check it out, I think. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
But first, I think the only way to get into our review of 2002's Spider-Man is with a Willem Dafoe Green Goblin cackle.
And go, Josh.
I'm hoping Sam just drops a real one in there. Because I don't think I can do it. I'll try.
Oh, you'll try. I love it.
I'll try, but and then Sam has the option.
Okay.
To edit me out. I'm trying to remember the best cackle part. Okay.
That was scary.
Okay.
You gotta do that. Maybe you gotta go with that, Sam. I know I don't have to tell you that. That was Defoe-esque.
Thank you.
That wasn't like your Schwarzenegger at all.
No, I'm pretty confident of that.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.